Do I need to hold it?
No.
No? And it works if I stand. Okay. And there's a timer on there as well. That's fantastic. Time known, I'm an alcoholic. I'm always terrified to share. And Grant, referring to my abbreviated share, was actually the second to last time I spoke. And I ended up passing out in the middle of my share, which I told you that. Don't look at me like that. And so, yeah, that was not fun. But I've shared plenty of times about passing out, so I'm not expecting it to happen today. Anyways, I always start at the beginning, which was when I was born. And my parents had tried really hard to have a kid for a long time before they were finally able to have me. My mom kept having miscarriages. And so when I was brought into the world, it was kind of with a bit more fanfare than I deserved. And my parents were thrilled to kind of finally have this son that they could focus 100% of their energy and their money on. And so I was brought up to think that I was, you know, not just special, but extraordinarily special. And that was an attitude that helped me in some regards, but that ended up crippling me in others. And in terms of how it didn't end up helping me, it was being in kindergarten or being in elementary school and just thinking that I could kind of charm my way through everything by sounding more intelligent than I was, or kind of being overfamiliar with adults, pretending that I was older than I was. And it left me rather friendless rather early. And thus began kind of a long period of me being truly unable, as it says in the four steps that we read today, to form a true partnership with another human being. And I was, on all accounts for a long time, a very happy, rather well-adjusted kid that no one would have ever suspected the least bit of trouble with. I had everything that I could ever need. My parents, although they worked all the time, and I was left, you know, kind of as a latchkey kid by myself at the house, would have stopped their lives in a heartbeat to give me anything. And I knew that. And it wasn't long, though, before I started to kind of take advantage of that fact. And my drinking started kind of as this little mini cocktail waiter for my parents, who would have these big cocktail parties, and they thought it would just be adorable if their son would wander around and ask, you know, the adults present what they wanted to drink, go tell my parents, learn how to make the drinks, and then bring the drink to them, and then learn how to schmooze and talk about stuff that I really had no business talking about. And so I think by the time I was 9, I knew how to butcher, you know, a couple different mixed drinks, and I started trying them. And it was more so that I was, even as like a 9-year-old, even that young, I wanted to seem older or sophisticated or something. So I figured, you know, if I learned how to drink like my parents, that would somehow, you know, make me grand and special. And, I mean, for a while it was harmless enough. But once things started to go down in my life, and that was mostly due to just a pretty unfortunate series of episodes it was sexual abuse for 4 years that I kept to myself and that I didn't talk about. And that was from when I was 8 until I was 12. And by the time I was 12, or 13, I was hurting really badly. And I was pissed that no one really seemed to realize that I was hurting that badly. So it all just, everything that I ended up doing was just trying to scream out like that I was somehow in pain and I needed someone to notice me. And my actions got more and more dramatic and more crazy. And so we were living in this really, really snobby, awful city in Louisville, or neighborhood in Louisville. And we lived there from when I was born, basically, until I moved for 8th grade out to this little country house that we had in the middle of the boonies next to members of the KKK and other such nonsense. And none of the routine that I tried to pull back in Anchorage would work there. Like, not at all. I was beaten up in school. I was despised by the bus driver for some reason, who really took an instant dislike to me. And it, like, things just started to fall apart, and my compensation for that was to just turn into even more of a spoiled brat than I ever was. And so I started drinking, and I'd drink by myself. In our house, I would find the liquor cabinet, and I'd try and see if I could make those old drinks that my parents taught me how to make, and I'd have some myself. And there was a feeling that generally most alcoholics get, that there was just something that felt right about that, something that felt very, very, very right about me drinking. And that gave me a sense of myself that I had at that point lost. And by the time I was 15, any sort of lingering traces of the young, happy, cute, innocent kid were gone. They were gone. I rejoiced in telling my mother that I thought she was a stupid, ugly bitch, and that she was just like her parents, who were abusive alcoholics. And I told my dad I thought it was, you know, vacant and empty and distant and mean and awful and all this stuff. And we couldn't have a conversation without yelling at one another. And I was trying to process all the stuff that had happened from the years that I was 8 until I was 12. And I wasn't doing a very good job of it on my own. And so the drinking accelerated and other things accelerated. I stopped eating. I started cutting myself for a period of time. And it sort of culminated in a suicide attempt when I was, it was January the 23rd, 2000. And so I believe that would have made me 16. And I decided the week before that I was going to kill myself. On that day, that I was going to, you know, not that I was going to make a decision that following week, and I was either going to do it and carry it through, or I was never going to consider the alternative again. And I went online, I looked in the physician's desk reference to find out exactly what the amount of milligrams of the sleeping medication that I had been prescribed, because I wasn't sleeping, because I was doing all this other stuff, would be necessary for me to do that. And I remember that night I had stashed, you know, the number of pills that I needed, and my parents had wanted to go to this one restaurant, which I didn't particularly care for, and they didn't really understand why I was so vocal about it that night, that I really wanted something else to eat. And we went, it was Garrett's, it was a steakhouse, and it was one of the most surreal meals I'd ever had. And that night we got home, and, you know, I kissed my parents goodnight without, you know, just kind of like, well, I didn't even kiss them goodnight. I think we said goodnight. We went our separate ways. I stayed up. I watched TV for a while. And then around midnight, I went and got the pills, and then I had had some Percocets left over from a wisdom teeth removal operation that I'd had previously. And I took a Percocet along with a couple shots of vodka. And then I made the decision to go ahead and take the sleeping pills. And it was very cold. There was snow on the ground. And I went around outside, and we had these nice little gardens on the side of our house that had a fish pond. And I was walking around feeling not necessarily much of anything at that point, except that I knew that I had done something that I had never done before and that I didn't know what was going to happen. But it was strange. There was a sudden feeling that I had that was almost kind of, I was pissed at myself, that how could I be that stupid to think that even though every single other aspect of my life was going that badly, that I at all would have had the wherewithal to make a decision of that importance. And it was a sense of panic, but it was also just a sense that, like, I knew that there was a possibility, however distant, that things could get better. So I went inside and picked up the phone and called 911. And by this point, I'm hardly able to move. And was talking to this lovely little emergency operator. And she asked me if I had ever done this before. And I said, no. I got this really snarky tone with her. And then I told her the exact, you know, milligram dose that I took and what I'd read that they should do when they arrive. And I was giving orders, basically, to the nice lady that worked on the phone. And she's like, okay, we're sending someone over. And so I figured it would probably be wise to try and wake up my parents and let them know that an ambulance was coming to take me away. So I went upstairs, and I stood in front of my parents' door, and I didn't feel... like, I had my hand on the doorknob for what felt like a really long time, because I didn't want to go in there and wake them up and tell them, and finally I did. And that was the last thing I remember. My parents said that I passed out on the floor of their room, was rushed to the hospital, had my stomach pumped and had to take the charcoal and all of this stuff. And I remember waking up that next morning not feeling like I had this new will to live, but feeling pissed that my parents were in the room looking at me like that. And I believe I called my mom a stupid bitch. Like, those were the first words that came out of my mouth. And to have gone from that kid to that, I didn't even realize it. Like, it felt perfectly natural for me. And they took me into the psychiatric ward of the hospital after that, after they kind of got my bodily condition stabilized. And I remember walking through and being like, these people are crazy. These people are nuts. I shouldn't be here. They don't have scholarships to high school. They weren't, you know, experts at the piano. They didn't know how to do any of that stuff. I shouldn't be here. And then they had the audacity to tell me that there wasn't a bed available, so they were going to have to put me on a cot. And I said, there's no way you're putting me on a cot. And I threw this big fit, and finally my parents, you know, chimed in, and they got me a little bed anyways. And that's, I mean, it was all like that. I mean, it's kind of comical to look back and just how unrealistically obnoxious I was, with little to no sense of just anything about my life at that point. But it was terrifying in that I was, it didn't get better after that. It didn't at all. I went for another year and a half of terrifying my parents, basically getting almost expelled from a scholarship that I had, a full scholarship to, a high school I had a full scholarship to, and having my parents move me out of my room and sequester me into the servants' quarters area of the house. Which, you know, wasn't that bad. I guess it was kind of bachelor's pad. But it was symbolic to me, and I was forbidden to go to any of the parts in the house. I had a refrigerator that I was allowed to use in the basement. And we, at that point, could no longer talk. And my friends were getting annoyed with my theatrics, and my drinking had accelerated. And even though I was on medicine where I was told that if I drank on it, I was going to destroy my liver by the time I was 25, I continued drinking. And there was a 6-month period where I said, you know, I'm not going to drink. This is really bad for me. I'm not going to be like the other alcoholics in my family. I don't want that for myself. And I couldn't do it. I tried really, really hard, and I just couldn't. And that was the first kind of glimmer that I had that I might have a problem. But it certainly wasn't enough for me to ever be like, you know, I need to actually stop this. I would have, in some ways, been happy with someone thinking that I was an alcoholic. Like, I would have thought it was cool to have a psychiatrist at that point tell me I was an alcoholic because I was just that far gone. And I was told I was an alcoholic, but I wasn't going to do anything about it. So there was, this was February the 18th, 2001. My parents woke me up in the middle of my winter break and said, there's a car waiting. We are going to the airport. You are going to this place called Choices in Florida, and we're going to go there together. And I said, no, I have a massage today at 3. And they said, well, you'll get a massage there or something. And so we go, and I'm kind of getting nervous at this point because I noticed my dad's unable, like, he won't let me out of his sight, and he's keeping just total watch over me. And we get there, and we walk into this office where we meet with one of the therapists, and they inform me that they are leaving the next day, and I am staying indefinitely. And I bitched and moaned and hollered like I had never bitched and moaned and hollered in my entire life. And then had an intake with the therapist where I told her that my suicide attempt was not really a suicide attempt in the classical sense as much as it was an existential crisis that I was undergoing, and that she needed to understand that. At which point she looked at me and she said, Noah, do you really want to know what I think? And I said, sure, lady, tell me what you think. She said, I think you're a spoiled brat. I think you're desperately unhappy, and I don't see you doing anything that you want to do with your life. And you've got problem after problem. None of it's going to address because you've held everyone hostage by this crappy-ass routine that you do. And no one had ever spoken to me like that, ever. And it was the following day where I was at this treatment center, you were pretty much required to go to, everyone had to go to this AA meeting at 6:30 in the morning, every morning. And it wasn't, and the treatment center was outpatient. You lived with people that were going to therapy there. Most of the people that went to therapy there also went to the meeting. But there were others who didn't. And I was sitting next to this El Salvadoran guy, Jared, when they had the time to give up desire chips. And he kept nudging me. And I'm like, stop nudging me. Like, no. And he just kept nudging me. And then eventually, because, I don't know, for whatever reason, I don't know why I got up and got a desire chip. I think it was because I knew I had a problem. I think maybe it was because I wanted the attention of getting up and having people clap. It could have been any number of things at that time. But I got up and I got my desire chip, but I refused to say in a meeting that I was an alcoholic for about 2 weeks. And then finally I gave in on that one too because people were giving me too much grief over, not saying that I was an alcoholic. So I started to say it. But I didn't believe that I was an alcoholic for a long, long time. And I had a sponsor who kept me on the first step for a good 8 months. And he said, we're not moving. You don't get to fly through this like you would a normal course. And this isn't, not going to be able to be a higher achiever here. I'm going to keep you on this. I don't think you see what you're doing. And so we would go step by step through my history. We went through all of it. Every single thing was poured over again and again and again in detail. And there was a moment in a meeting, I think I had been sober about 8 months, where I felt something break. It was literally a feeling like something was breaking inside of me. And for one of the first times in my life, like the walls that I had erected over the years kind of just started to go. And it was one of the most terrifying yet beautiful feelings I'd ever had. And at that point, I still was hell-bent on certainly not having fun with people in AA, and certainly not looking like I enjoyed going to AA, and certainly not telling people that I ever got anything out of it. And all of that was just masking this huge, huge, huge pit of fear that I carried with me for such a long time that you could ask me any number of things about, postmodern art, whatever, and I would have rattled on with words that I didn't really know what they meant and talk about, just crap. But if you asked me what I liked about life or what I valued about anything, I couldn't have responded because I didn't know that I had lost so much myself at that point. And drinking was part of that. And there was a complicated part of me getting sober was that, yes, I got sober when I was 17. I had only really been drinking for about 2 years. I never drank and drove. I never felt like physically addicted to alcohol. There were a lot of, not yet, that I would constantly throw in the face of anyone that, would tell me I was an alcoholic. But I was on that road, most certainly. And I was on a very unhappy road. And I think that was my saving grace, is that I was that desperately unhappy so fast, and that I had hit such a bottom in terms of hating myself and my life and having no idea what I wanted to do with myself, that I was desperate to, kind of as the dying can be, to do whatever would make me happy. And there came a point where if it took me to participate in AA for me to get happy, then I was going to do it. And sure enough, much to my dismay, I kind of started to get happy in AA. And that was a terrifying experience for me. Because people started to notice that I started to look better, I smiled more, I spoke more, I wasn't as obnoxious. And people would tell me these things. And it wasn't like the accolades I got from professors or teachers about, you know, writing something or sounding smart or seeming older than I was. There were people that, you know, saw me for who I was, which was a very troubled young person, and who wasn't impressed with any of my shit. And I have never encountered people who spoke the truth to me in any other part of my life than I have at AA. It just doesn't come about. And I needed to hear the truth again and again and again and again. And I had a sponsor, a co-sponsor, a sponsor in another program. I was living with people that were sober. I was going to meetings every single morning at 6:30. I had therapy groups that met twice a week. I had a big book study on Wednesdays. I was sponsoring two people by the time I was 2 years sober. And I was involved, and I was made to be involved. And it was only through that that I kept getting these little awarenesses about my condition and about being an alcoholic and about my history, that I started to accept it for myself. And it came in bits and pieces. And a lot of people have either the gift or not of hitting a pretty serious bottom where they know for themselves before they walk into the door that they've got a problem with alcohol that needs to stop. And I didn't feel that way. So it came at removes, and it came very slowly. And it's still likely, I mean, even after, I guess, 5 years today, there are moments where I get that old, stupid, adolescent voice in my head that's like, you know, whatever, you were 17. You knew plenty of 17-year-olds that drank like you did. And I did. But those 17-year-olds weren't trying to kill themselves. They weren't cutting themselves. They were functioning. They were happy. They were at least relatively happy. And I simply couldn't. I do not function when I drink. I can't have it around me. It sucks my insides dry and left me barren. And it was... I started to learn that, like, the more I started to reveal about myself and the different walls that I kind of would knock down, like, the more movement I made and the happier I started to feel. And it was very gradual. It started with, like, you know, making admissions about my drinking history, then making admissions about being terribly insecure around hanging around people that were my age. Then it was making admissions about, you know, sexuality, all of it. And it was all very gradual, and it was all really painful. But there were about 5 to 6 people that I called every night for about 4 years. And I was fathered and mothered, and I was, you know, for an only child to have people that acted like brothers and all of that, was unbelievable. I mean, I would have, you know, silly little random embarrassing health issues and questions about sex that I could ask my sponsor about that I certainly would never ask my dad about. And that was just a really beautiful gift. And so I was in Orlando getting sober there for, let's see, I was there for 3.5 years. And then I ended up going to McGill. And leaving Orlando and leaving that community and leaving that support was one of the single most painful things I had done. And no one was going to let me jump out of that process. It was a period of increasingly difficult goodbyes. And people were like, we want you to feel this. We want you to feel what it's like to leave a place like this. And so that you can carry that inside you always. And I was terrified. The community that I was living in was gorgeous, but in terms of how it operated, like the rest of the world operated, it didn't. I was kept in a pretty sheltered environment. People that I worked with for a long time were all sober. I lived with sober people. All of my friends were sober. I never once had to deal with being around alcohol for the entire 3.5 year period. I was in therapy, like, all the time. And so it was a very different life to go from that to coming up to Montreal, not knowing anyone, going to McGill, which was recently voted one of the top 10 party schools in North America by Playboy magazine. And it was just a different world entirely. And the first time I spoke was at a young people's meeting, because I had met Dave at Sunday Nighters, and he asked me to share there. And that was when I started to get involved here. And, I mean, in all honesty, I think that there have been many moments where I could certainly, I mean, there's a lot more that I could do here that I did when I was in Orlando that I haven't done. And there have been parts of my program that I had in Orlando that I have let go of, and certainly with consequences to, you know, maybe emotional stability and emotional maturity. And I think I've gone through a bit of a rebellious phase where I've tried to redefine, okay, how am I going to live as a 22-year-old who's been sober for 5 years in a city, away from that therapy community that's had its drawbacks and its up and downs, and I'm still trying to figure it out. But I can tell you, like, the benefits, like, the gifts that started coming to me came so rapidly and was so overwhelming that I didn't feel like I could put words to it. And I would start speaking in meetings, and the only thing that would come out would be I'd just cry, like, that was it. It was the only thing that made sense to me. It was just that I loved the life that I was getting, and I had no idea how I was getting it. And I don't know. I mean, even I went to Singapore for 6 months, back from September until January. And even there was AA, and the AA was very different, but it was still AA. My grandmother died while I was there. She was someone that I was very close to. And to go through that from a distance, and to not be able to go home for the funeral because I had midterms and it would have been impossible and enormously expensive to get a last-minute plane ticket to do that, was really hard. But AA was the only place where I felt safe to talk about it. And I went in there and I cried for 2 weeks. And to have a place like this where you can go as a 22-year-old who's still trying to figure out who they are and how to live life, is a gift that not very many 22-year-olds get. And there are lots of people my age who get confused by the fact that I don't drink and who get confused by the fact that I go to AA. And I have parents who consistently are like, well, why don't you just start drinking now? And so there are always outside forces that are like, you know, we want you to fit into the normal 22-year-old mold, and I wouldn't give it up for sure. I have little thoughts sometimes that are like, you know, maybe it would be easier when I was going out with a group of people to not be the one that was, you know, drinking Perrier or something. But I don't think it would. I don't think it would. It would get so bad so fast, and I know it. And I know in the part of myself that doesn't really listen to that shit. So I think I've been more than I really could have ever imagined, because I had such a shitty beginning, and because I was given that shitty beginning to learn to appreciate what I've been given, and I don't think I could want it any differently. So that's it. Thanks.
Thank you.